And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
And you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. This is Bill Frank, your host, and our theme in the first hour is finding your dream. Each of my guests is discussing what it means to have a dream boss or to find a dream job. My next guest has what I consider a dream job. He's a leader in financial news reporting. He's the co-anchor of CNBC's Closing Bell. He's a capable reporter who believes in educating his viewers on the market workings as much as reporting the stories. We'll discuss making sense of the markets in turbulent times. And as always, if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Bill Griffith is one of the most respected financial journalists in the country with almost 30 years' experience in business television. He's the co-anchor of CNBC's Closing Bell, a duty that he shares with Maria Bartiromo. Bill is best known for his quick wit and his ability to think on his feet. He brings extensive knowledge of the markets and market history to CNBC's programming. Bill was part of the production team that started the Financial News Network way back in 1981. It was the first cable channel devoted exclusively to business news. In 1991, when NBC bought Financial News Network, Bill joined CNBC's team. He has garnered 6 cable ace nominations during his tenure. Bill has always believed in educating viewers about how the markets work is as important as informing them about the latest news. He received his bachelor's degree here locally in journalism in 1980 from Cal State University at Northridge. Welcome to the show, Bill. How are you today?
Hey, Bill. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on today.
It's our pleasure. And thanks so much for being our guest. So, local boy comes home, Cal Northridge boy. Now, I want to get into the financial aspects, if we can, and talk a little bit about headline risk. Because headline risk seems to be dominating the financial news. The tragedy in Japan, our hearts go out to the people there. The political turmoil in the Middle East, rising oil prices. As a veteran financial news reporter, what impact has all of this had on the world economy, or will all of this have on the world economy?
You know, we're still trying to assess that right now because we're still not sure exactly how the tragedy in Japan is going to play out. I mean, they're still trying to get their arms around the nuclear plants and exactly how much damage that's going to do. Luckily, and I agree with you, I mean, our hearts go out. It's a very much a human tragedy first and foremost, and we can never forget that. But luckily, from an economic standpoint, the region that it most affected is not the strongest area for the economy of Japan. You know, Japan's got the third largest economy in the world, and it's a very important part of the world economy. But most of the area that's been most affected is, as we know, the northeastern part of Japan, and the southwestern and parts north of that are the big economic industrialized areas that manufacture parts for automobiles, for technology companies and things like that. So we're still trying to figure out exactly what impact this will have. But so far, the world markets are pretty much taking this all in stride and betting that it won't have as much of an impact as we might have imagined in those early days after the earthquake and the tragic tsunami.
Well, remarkable to me was that the stock market in Tokyo did not close. I think it may have closed for a day after the tragedy, but that was about it. It sprung back immediately, whereas if we take a look at the turmoil in the Middle East, the Egyptian stock market remained closed until, what, just yesterday, wasn't it?
Right. I mean, you're talking about two different kinds of governments there. I mean, there was a major regime change in Egypt where they were trying to figure out what direction they were going to go politically. So it took quite a while for them to get their own stock market open. For Japan, you know, that's a huge market, and to have it finally get open after a couple of days, and we did see tremendous volatility right away, but then after that, a lot of a lot of pretty savvy investors were saying, you know, let's take a look here and guess what impact this will have on the Japanese economy, and they felt that the initial sell-off in the Japanese market following the tragedy may have been a bit overdone, and they were willing to step up. I mean, I can't tell you the number of people on the air who have said to me that they had already made a new investment in Japan, first one that they've made in maybe a decade, anticipating, you know, a growth. Let's remember also that when you get an infrastructure dislocation, as you might want to call it, the magnitude that we're seeing in Japan right now, what follows that eventually is a major reconstruction effort, and that can be a boost to a region's economy. Now, as we all know, Japan has been in something of an economic funk for the last 15 years or so. They had a lost decade in the 1990s. This could be a catalyst that will help to jumpstart their economy again. So there are a lot of savvy investors out there who are betting that the reconstruction that will follow this tragedy will make it a stronger economy, and maybe the strongest economy that we've seen there in a generation.
Well, and that's good advice. You don't have to go to Japan to make those investments either. You could invest in Caterpillar right here in the United States and probably take advantage of some of that reconstruction as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are these exchange-traded funds that have become so popular here in the United States that some of them are devoted exclusively to Japanese stocks. So there are plenty of ways that you can invest in Japan. Absolutely.
Absolutely. We're talking to Bill Griffith, everybody, co-anchor of CNBC's Closing Bell. Bill, you are in the catbird seat at that particular desk because you report the news during probably the most crucial hour of the trading day. Yesterday, for instance, we saw about a 40-point swing from the positive to the negative in the final hour alone. But help me to make sense of what's going on right now in the markets, because in recent days there have been some remarkable trends. Trading volume is notably low. Volatility is also notably low. Gold, oil, and the stock markets appear to be moving in the same direction. That's a head puzzler, because usually oil and gold will move in the opposite direction of the stock market and so forth. So I'm scratching my head here, Bill. Help us to make some sense of all of this conflicting data.
Well, I will say that you've encapsulated it very well, Bill. I mean, you're obviously a student of what goes on in the markets here, and you've done a good job of that. And I would point out that there are plenty of very smart people out there who are asking themselves the very same question. I've always been a believer in the message of the markets. And let me diverge for just a second here. You know, the one thing I've learned in my many years of covering Wall Street is that you and I individually may not know exactly what's going on, but the markets know what's going on. And the interesting thing is that collectively, you and I are the markets. So as individuals, we sit here trying to figure out what the message of the markets is right now, but the markets are anticipating a few things. They're anticipating more growth. They're anticipating inflation. They're anticipating that the Federal Reserve is going to have to raise interest rates at some point as the economy continues to strengthen and prices continue to rise. So you're getting these what would seem to be counterintuitive intermarket actions right now. As you point out, you don't often see some of the commodity prices like a gold or an oil go higher even as the stock market goes higher. But I think what it points to is the remarkable financial dislocation that we experienced in 2008 and 2009. I mean, that was a very scary time, and we're coming out of it. And the way we're coming out of it is through growth for companies that have a much better balance sheet than they used to have, as they've deleveraged, they've reduced their debt levels, and they are, you know, in better shape now to try and grow their companies. And we're seeing a lot of growth in commodities because of international demand right now. So international demand for oil, international demand for a lot of the food that is grown in the San Joaquin Valley, for example. You know, international demand for gold, certainly, by a lot of the central banks around the world. So we're coming out of a very, very bad economic time in 2008 and 9, and we're seeing the growth that is reflected now in the stock market and in the various commodities that you cited at the same time.
Oh, boy, I love it. A very optimistic outlook from Bill Griffith, who's the co-anchor of CNBC's Closing Bell. Bill, let's talk about commodities real quickly, and this is just a one-liner. The one commodity that is the puzzlement to me of all of them, it's not oil, it's not gold or any of the hard commodities, it's cotton. Cotton inflation has been rampant over the last 12 months. What is the deal? Why are so many people demanding cotton? Is there that much of a demand for Levi's blue jeans?
You have to remember that we are truly in an international, a global economy now. So while the price may reflect tremendous demand, not all that demand is coming from our own country. There are plenty of countries. India, huge consumer of cotton. You know, they make a huge textile manufacturing country right now. Vietnam has become very big in textiles. Of course, China is a huge consumer of many commodities, and that would include cotton. So a lot of the demand may not be just from the United States, but and the many uses that there are for cotton around the globe. International demand, I think, is what you can point to for the rise in the price of many of the commodities that may not reflect the demand that's in the United States, but instead coming from other parts of the world.
Now, there's a very cogent explanation for it. Bill, let's turn our attention to the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank President, James Bullard, who is always very vocal. He's made it very clear that he believes that it's time that we seriously start thinking about an exit strategy from the second round of quantitative easing, or what some people call QE2. What are the implications for our economy when the Fed announces the end of QE2?
Well, right now there is a scheduled end to QE2, this $600 billion injection of capital that the Federal Reserve has been putting into the economy since last September. It's scheduled to end in June, but there is a tremendous debate among the Federal Reserve Bank presidents and the Federal Reserve governors that maybe it would be more prudent to end it sooner rather than later. And what Mr. Bullard has been advocating today is taking away $100 billion of the $600 billion that is still scheduled to go into the economy, and because the economy is growing, prices are going up, as you're pointing out, and they risk, an inflationary period that they would not be able to control. I mean, that's really the mandate of the Federal Reserve. Let's remember, their mandate is to maintain stable prices in the economy. And the way they do that is by either injecting or taking out money into the economy or out of the economy. They raise rates, they lower rates, all those things that have an impact on commerce in the United States. And they do it in the name of maintaining stable prices. So the thing that they fight the most is inflation. And the thing that they fear right now is that they've been keeping interest rates so low for so long to try and stabilize our economy from the crisis we had in 08 and 09, that perhaps they risk overdoing it and creating an environment where inflation takes off, much like what we saw in the late 1970s. Those who are advocating ending QE2, quantitative easing is what that means, QE2. It's the second time they've done this. That's why it's QE2. Those advocating the end of QE2 sooner rather than later are fearing inflation. Those who are advocating maintaining the schedule that they put out for themselves and ending it in June are saying, it's still not clear that the economy is on the soundest footing right now. Let's not forget, unemployment is still around 9%.
Yes, it is.
The housing market is still in the doldrums. Just this morning, we got another report that many of the major markets in this country, the housing markets, are still in the doldrums. So there are plenty of things you can point to that say the economy is still not on completely sound footing yet, and you still need to keep the lower interest rates and inject the money into the system that the Federal Reserve has been doing. So that's the debate that's going on right now.
We're talking to Bill Griffith, co-anchor of CNBC's Closing Bell. Bill, there are always two sides to any trade. There are those people who know that the scheduled end of QE2 is June of this year, but there are some people out there that are saying that we probably need QE3. Quick yes or no answer. Do we need a QE3 based on what you see?
I don't know that it's anybody's going to listen to my recommendation, but there are plenty of people still who feel that we will need QE3 if the impact of the Japan crisis has a greater impact than anticipated. You know, there are a lot of variables out there that would point to continued weakness in the economy. The housing market, as I just mentioned, the jobs market. If those have not picked up by the summertime, you'll hear people talking about the possibility of QE3. But I will tell you, it'll be a very, very tough sell this third time around.
I would have to agree with that. Bill, let's turn our attention to your career, because you have been on the forefront of financial news reporting from the get-go, first with the Financial News Network, which was later absorbed by NBC.
Right.
I want to ask you, on a bigger picture level, now that you've had nearly 30 years in this business, what is the impact of the 24-hour-a-day news cycle, and particularly the business reporting cycle? What impact has that had on investing and investors?
You use the word cycle, and that's the proper way to look at this. The markets work in cycles. You know, we have bull markets, we have bear markets, we have growth periods, we have recessionary periods. I mean, that's just part of the normal cycle that goes on in the economy and the markets. What the 24-hour trading cycle, what the ability to gain information at any time of the day through the internet, what that's has served to do is speed up those cycles. And that's the simplest answer. I mean, things happen so quickly now. People get the information and immediately they're able to trade. They don't have to wait for the markets to open, because there is a market. There's always a market open somewhere in the world, and you have access to that market if you want. So what it does is it just speeds up the process, and we have a shortening of cycles, booms to busts and back. That I think is only going to increase as time goes on.
Well, I would agree with you there. I think another thing that has helped speed up investing has been the move that the New York Stock Exchange went from decimals to, from fractions to decimals.
Right,
they got
right.
away from the 1/8, then they started going to the decimal system, and that has really triggered this computer-based trading that you see out there as well.
That is for sure. That is the way people trade now, and that speeds things up as well. Very, very high-speed trading that goes on any given day.
Yeah. We're talking to Bill Griffith, who is the co-anchor of CNBC's Closing Bell, also a graduate of Cal State University at Northridge. Proudly so. Yeah, bring it on home to Ventura County. Love that. But, Bill, if you were advising a Northridge grad right now about going into business today, what would you tell him or her to do?
That's a very good question. I think... we're in a period. I mean, one of the hallmarks of the U.S. economy has always been the ability, we have very low barriers to starting your own business, and the barriers have never been lower than they are now. The only stumbling block you may have is finding the financing to start a business. But if you have a good idea, I think that can be the first place you want to think about. To think about is to begin your own business. I mean, have the creativity, have the courage of your convictions to go for it and start your own business. It may not work. Failure is a great teacher, but I think it can be. This is the time to do it. You know, once you get later in your career, if you've worked for major corporations, it's tougher to leave and start your own business. Now is the time to be thinking about what you are interested in, what your talents are, where your interests lie, and to start your own business. I think that'd be the thing I would tell people.
Well, that's great advice. A little bit counterintuitive, but that's what the times call for.
I agree. That's where the job growth is right now. I mean, if what job growth we do have in the economy is coming from those people who are starting their own businesses. The small business growth engine is very much alive in this country.
And I'm glad to hear that. We've been talking to Bill Griffith, who is the co-anchor of CNBC's Closing Bell. Bill, I know you're on deadline. You need to get downtown so you can be on the set of the show for Closing Bell. If people want to learn more about you, they like what they hear, and they want to learn more, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
We have our website at CNBC.com. You'll find it all right there.
CNBC.com, and there's a full biography of Bill as well as video clips from some of the episodes of Closing Bell as well. Bill, thank you so much for being our special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
My pleasure, Bill. Thanks very much for having me. A great, great show.
Take care. We'll talk to you later.